Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, copyright, touts and prints. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
How the devil are you?
I thought I'd say hello in a different way this week, because I always say it the same way. Variety is the spice of life, as they say.
Yes, they do, but they always say that. They really want to build a bit more variety into that saying.
Yeah, you shouldn't have cliches about there being more need for variety. So this week, as we record this, last week, as people listen, just to be clear.
You're confusing things already.
It was you who wanted clarity on this podcast a few weeks ago.
So I've given up on that now.
Last week was the final industry takeover seminar of 2018. Mm-hmm. So that's the monthly night that we do as CMU DIY and Urban Development down at the Red Bull Studios. And it's monthly from January through June.
Yeah.
So the last one, 2018, was last week. And it was another good session. Lots of people were there. It was all good. And this season of the industry takeover seminar has had a drinks sponsor.
Wow.
For the first time, a rum brand. So basically everyone who's been to each event gets a free shot of rum when they arrive. I don't know whether that was based on feedback from the previous year.
I often need a drink before I listen to you for an hour.
Perhaps it was that the feedback from 2017 was the only way we can sit through Chris Cook talking about copyright for 20 minutes is with a shot of rum. But I don't know, because I wasn't involved in getting this drinks brand on board. But because it was the last one of the year, as I was leaving, the other people who organised it, they handed me a bottle of this rum.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, I don't drink.
I do know that.
So,
having been in pubs with you.
So it was sort of like, well, it's not really use to me. But I thought it would be sort of, you know, it would be rude to knock back the free gift, wouldn't it?
Well, there are two meanings of knock back, aren't there?
Oh, that's true. In the context.
I think it probably wouldn't be rude. It would be odd to suddenly knock back an entire bottle of rum just as someone had handed it to you.
So anyway, I felt that it would be rude to knock it back in the sense of refuse to accept it.
Yeah.
So I took it with me. And then this morning, as we record this.
Yeah.
I was sitting at my laptop writing my CMU daily stories like I do every morning.
Well, some mornings.
And I got a little alert on my laptop that told me that tomorrow is your birthday.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's true, because I don't know when your birthday is, but my laptop seems pretty certain that tomorrow is your birthday, which may or may not be true. But you never argue with a laptop, do you? So I thought when that little alert popped up, oh, this is brilliant, because now I can offload this rum onto you and pretend that it's some sort of really generous birthday present.
Yes. So, well, I'll pretend you didn't just say all of that.
So here we go. I've got a bottle of rum.
Oh, that looks nice.
For you. Duppy Share Caribbean rum.
Mm.
From Jamaica and Barbados. I don't know how it can be from both. I don't know, I think they fill half the bottle in Barbados and then ship it over to Jamaica. And that would be very environmentally friendly, would it?
No, but then shipping it over here just from the Caribbean generally is not that environmentally friendly.
It's kind of ironic that 2 years ago I went to Barbados to talk about the music industry and I didn't bring you back any rum. And then last year I went to Jamaica to talk about the music industry and I didn't bring you any rum. This week I went to London Bridge and there you go.
Well, thank you very much for this generous offer.
There's a bottle of rum for your birthday.
Thank you very much.
Now this week, after we've recorded this edition of the podcast, we're then going to take a 5-minute break and then we're going to record two of our special 20th anniversary editions, which are going to go out in subsequent weeks because we've got a couple of weeks where we won't be around to do a proper podcast. So maybe between the two recording sessions, you could down a little bit of that rum.
I might knock it all back.
And see whether that makes for a better podcast. I think it might.
I don't think we've ever done a drunk podcast.
No, we in the very olden days, we were sort of V-7 of this podcast, when it wasn't called Setlist. It's called the CMU podcast, but not this version of the CMU podcast, that version.
Let's not
go
over all the different versions of the CMU podcast.
There was a version of the CMU podcast that we used to record in our meeting room in our old office on Shoreditch High Street, where there was that whole run where I would nip to the local shop, which for some reason, rather than selling Fanta and Tango and Coca-Cola, sold all sorts of weird fizzy drinks.
Yes.
And I used to bring you what looked to be the most disgusting of the fizzy drinks I could find for you to drink during the podcast.
Yes.
Do you remember that
I
era?
I do. I'm still getting the taste out of my mouth of some of them.
So maybe we should resurrect that, but with alcohol.
I'm all for it.
Ironically, when I was a student.
Yeah.
It's quite a long time ago.
It's a very long time ago.
When I was a student and on very, very rare occasions, my friends, because I had some then, would very occasionally, like, really peer pressure me into having an alcoholic drink, even though I don't drink.
And you caved.
And on the very odd occasions I cave, well, first of all, I would usually say, all right, then I'll have a cup of coffee with a shot of Bailey's in it, because that's actually quite nice. But they would laugh at me and say, that's not what we meant. And so the one thing I would almost tolerate was rum and Coke.
Yeah.
Because rum and Coke just tastes like slightly flat Coke. And I could tolerate. So I'd rather have, you know, not flat Coke. But if I have to have an alcoholic drink, I would have rum and Coke because it was sort of like slightly flat Coke. But those were in the heady days of my youth when I would sometimes have maybe 2 alcoholic drinks a year.
Wow.
No more. So that's why I'm offloading that bottle of rum onto you.
Well, maybe you can resurrect your rum and Coke days and have some of this with me later. Although we haven't got any Coke, so we'll just have to have it. Well, we've got water and coffee.
But you're forgetting that not only do I not drink alcoholic drinks, I no longer drink fizzy drinks.
Yeah, well, we've got water. Rum and water is, I'm sure, a very nice drink.
Diluted rum is what you're suggesting.
We'll have, like, homeopathic boozing.
Oh, well, I'll do homeopathic boozing, because that would be a jug of water and a fraction tiny little drop of rum. So that, I'm sure...
A suggestion of rum.
I would gladly drink. So maybe we'll do that when we're recording the special editions. I've also brought Jaffa Cakes.
Yeah.
Can you hear the Jaffa Cakes?
Yes. I've already eaten some of them, so I don't need to hear them. Oh, you're doing that for texture.
Well, so that they... I generally have...
For the listener.
For the listener.
So professional. You presented it like you were talking to me, but you're really talking to the listener.
M&S Jaffa Cakes, which I think are better than the McVitie's.
Very controversial.
So if M&S are listening, I mean, it was very nice of Duppy Share. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
I should know that, really. It was very good of Duppy Share to be a partner on the Institute Takeover Seminar. But if M&S would like to send us a weekly batch of Jaffa Cakes for the podcast record. But during last week's recording of Setlist,
we
did it before lunch.
Yeah.
Whereas usually we do it after lunch.
Mm.
Or maybe I just hadn't had lunch.
It was definitely after lunch. Yeah, you just hadn't had any lunch. I'd had lunch.
So my stomach was kind of rumbling throughout the whole record. I think we managed to get that out in the edit.
I didn't notice it.
So hopefully you couldn't hear my stomach rumbling. But this week when
It did add about an extra half hour to the record.
Because we kept having to stop and wait for my stomach to stop rumbling. So I've come prepared this week. So whenever I feel my stomach about to start rumbling, I'm going to eat a Jaffa Cake and all will be fine.
Okay. Well, I also haven't eaten this time, so I don't know if we've got enough Jaffa Cakes.
You might be able to hear me chewing on Jaffa Cakes, which probably would be more distracting than a rumbling stomach. But anyway, while I'm doing that, why don't you tell us what we're talking about on this week's edition of Setlist?
Well, coming up this week, we've got calls for Google to stop taking Viagogo's money and new squabbling at the Prince Estate. But first, the music industry has unsurprisingly welcomed the latest stage in the life of Article 13 of the draft European Copyright Directive. Last week, it was passed by the Jury Committee of the European Parliament, which puts it another step closer in its very long journey to actually becoming law. Although there has recently been quite a backlash, so the tech lobby is ramping up its efforts to get it thrown out.
Yes, this is the European Copyright Directive, which has now somehow been going through the motions for nearly 2 years. September 2016 was when the European Commission published the first draft of the Copyright Directive, setting out to reform copyright law across the European Union, particularly with digital stuff in mind. So it's part of an initiative called the Digital Single Market. So most of the copyright reforms in some way relate to the internet. And there are a number of articles in there which are relevant to music. So there is the clause trying to get more transparency around the way music rights are exploited for the artists and musicians and songwriters who create that music. There is a clause for a contract adjustment mechanism, which is not just for the music industry, but could potentially have an impact on the music industry, mainly for session musicians, certainly in the original writing of that article. But the section of this copyright directive that certainly has been the biggest talking point in the music community is Article 13, the slightly ominously numbered Article 13, which is the safe harbour reforming article and the result of the value gap campaign that the music industry has been pursuing. Although it's the IFPI, which obviously represents the record industry and particularly the majors around the world. And I think maybe Impala, that speaks to the indie labels in Europe, they talk about the value gap campaign. On the publishing songwriting side, some of them insist on calling it the transfer of value.
It's not as snappy.
It's not as snappy. You'd think the songwriters, yeah. as lyricists at heart, would recognise that value gap is better than the transfer of value.
Yes.
But anyway, this all relates to the value gap campaign. So as a very, 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 very quick summary, how very, 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 very quick do you think my very, 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 very quick summary is going to be?
Well, once we've edited it down from its 2 hours, I reckon we can get it to 30 seconds.
30 seconds? Yeah. Do you want to time me? Do you think I can explain the safe harbour in 30 seconds?
Let's see.
I've genuinely not prepared this.
Hang on. 3, 2, 1, go.
So the safe harbour says that intermediaries on the internet, like internet service providers and server hosting companies, cannot be held liable when their customers use their services to infringe copyright online, providing they offer a service via which copyright material can be taken down. But user upload platforms like YouTube say they have safe harbour protection. The music industry says that they shouldn't, and that it is exploiting a loophole in copyright law in order to get unfairly preferential deals from the music industry. That's the safe harbour value gap issue. How long did that take?
That was exactly 30 seconds.
Woo! Look at that. We're definitely not editing that then, have I? Spot on. I've no idea if it made sense.
I'm really disappointed. I was just going to shout stop in the middle of your flow. Oh, well.
So that's the campaign. It's been going through the motions in Brussels for ages. There was about, I mean, I didn't count them, but I had a quick scan through the document. I reckon there was about 9,000,007 proposed amendments to the copyright directive. That might be tidal maths.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
allegedly. Yes.
But there was lots of amendments. So it's taken a very long time to go through the system. And in terms of how law gets made in the European Parliament, I've been brushing up on that this week. Or last week, getting the specifics of how these European directives go through. Because I knew the basics. Basically, in the European Union, the European Commission puts forward the proposals, and then they go to European Parliament, and they go to the EU Council. So European Parliament, those are the people that you elected, because I'm sure all of our listeners who live in the European Union always vote for an MEP in the European election. Do you vote for your MEP?
I do, but the Brexit vote did suggest that most people don't realise that that happens.
So we have the European Parliament, directly elected MEPs. The EU Council is made up of representatives of the governments of each of the member states of the European Union. And both of them take the proposals that the Commission put forward, and then they debate them and discuss them and amend them. And then Parliament gets a final draft that it's happy with, and the EU Council gets a final draft that it's happy with. And then the final stage, which is yet to come, the Parliament, Commission and Council all then have to sit down together and get their various reworks of the original document and try and agree a final version of the document. And then both Parliament and Council then have to rubber stamp that. And that's how you get a directive. But you mentioned the jury committee.
Yes.
So that actually stands for something. So it's J-U-R-I in capital letters. It's basically the Legal Affairs Committee of Parliament. And so, because Parliament's quite big, when you have a directive like this, a committee is appointed to discuss it. Actually, various committees have been discussing the copyright directive, but it was the jury committee who were in charge. And so the jury committee met last week to look at all the amendments and sort of the final draft that has been negotiated in Parliament. And then they voted on it, and they basically voted it through, including a draft of Article 13 that the music industry is happy with, which therefore means it's a draft of Article 13 which the tech sector are not happy with, and they would actually rather it be deleted entirely or be rewritten in such a waffly, ambiguous way that it basically means nothing.
Yeah, so the music industry, as we know, because, oh my God, we've talked about it so much on this show, has long argued against certain user upload platforms, mainly YouTube, having the safe harbour protection provided under copyright law, because the music industry says that was intended for ISPs, it wasn't intended for companies like YouTube. When that law was written, companies like YouTube didn't exist and weren't even imagined. So YouTube shouldn't have this protection, and that's what basically it wants to happen. Now, the critics in the tech sector argue that Article 13 will have unintended consequences, hindering innovation, free speech, and the social networking experience. And basically reckon that ultimately it'll just ruin the internet.
And you've mentioned that in the last few weeks, as these big votes have come up, so we knew there were going to be the voting jury and the voting council, as the big votes have appeared on the horizon, the music industry have been banging on about this for so long now, I'm bored of it. But the tech lobby, which have been critical from the start, but in recent weeks, I think because they sensed that the music and entertainment industry had sort of gained the lead in Parliament.
Yeah.
So they were most likely to get the version they wanted. The tech lobby have been really speaking out about this through various different campaign groups. And of course, you know, you have groups that aren't necessarily tech companies, but which are generally critical about copyright or what they might see as sort of excessive copyright protection. And so on the social networks, pretty much any tech website you might have been to in the last couple of weeks, there would have been an article on this with various politicians and entrepreneurs and campaigners, etc., all speaking out about not just Article 13, but the two articles that the tech sector are most critical of. It's Article 11, which is all to do about offering a new right to an extent to publishers, no, not music publishers, really it's for newspapers and news providers. So Article 11, which is sometimes referred to as the link tax by the people who don't like it.
Yep.
And then Article 13, and the critics are calling it the censorship machine or censorship engine.
Yes. Now that's the issue, isn't it? That while on the music industry side, they have, as you say, gained the upper hand with European Parliament, things are going well there, they're kind of getting what they want now, certainly moving in that direction. But the safe harbour, as any listeners to this show will know, is quite hard to explain and quite dry. Whereas the tech lobby has now happened upon the argument that this will ruin the internet, it's against free speech. And the big thing they've got now is saying that they're basically saying the EU is trying to make memes illegal. And that is a lot easier to say, no matter how true or not it is, than explaining safe harbours, even if you do it in 30 seconds.
And is more dramatic even than the whole value gap thing. Because although, yeah, as we said earlier, value gap's quite snappy, actually, it is nevertheless quite hard to explain why safe harbour is resulting in a value gap.
And in fact, countering those criticisms, after the vote went through last week, GSAC, which represents the songwriting collecting societies in Europe, put out a statement saying that this isn't an attempt to ruin the internet. They said, and quote, "The text provides legal safeguards and guarantees for the consumers to continue to post, access and share the content they enjoy on those platforms," which is just not as snappy as "they're going to ban memes."
No more cat GIFs is what the other side are saying. And it's interesting. We've been covering the latest developments. We ran a story in the CMU Daily where we quoted all the music industry people who were welcoming the vote in the jury committee in the European Parliament and saying, yes, we've won the argument at this stage. It's good. These MEPs, they know what they're talking about. And actually, one person on Twitter was critical of my write-up of all of that, because I suppose, as the whole safe harbour story has developed, I have sometimes been quite critical or quite cynical about all of this. And I think the reader felt that I was just allowing the music industry people to have their moment in the spotlight without really critiquing what they are saying. But I have to say, although I don't necessarily buy all of the... what's the expression? Drink the Kool-Aid, that's an expression, yeah, isn't it? Of what the music industry have been pushing on the whole value gap thing. When you come to the other side, the people who are being critical, I mean, obviously, it's right to be concerned about unintended consequences,
yes,
from new regulation going through. It's right to be concerned about that. But I sort of always lose sympathy with the other side when they equate enforcing copyright with censorship. And
yes,
they say this is about censorship. Because, well, it's not. You know, the fact that you might not be allowed to use a Katy Perry track in your video, that's not censorship.
No.
The fact that you won't be allowed to set up a YouTube channel and upload clips from Love Island or whatever show you're watching, that's not censorship. You know, the fact that you might not be able to nab other people's photographs and create an animated GIF out of them, that's not censorship. Okay, you can still say whatever you like, you can still make your own content, write your own songs, take your own photographs.
You have to put your text over a picture of your own cat.
And if you want to critique something, if you want to show a bit of music in order to critique it, well, you can do that under the critical analysis exception under copyright law. And if you want to mock something, and hell knows we like mocking things here, we would always support that, you can do that under the parody exception. And I accept that some of those copyright exceptions may not be clear enough in law, or there may be too many exceptions to the exceptions or whatever. But those exceptions exist. You know, copyright is constrained where critical analysis or parody is concerned. So it's wrong to say this is about censorship. Although, as I say, you probably are right to be concerned about unintended consequences. And I do stand by what we've said many, many times. And I did actually say it at the end of the report last week.
Who reads the end of these?
Who reads the end of the reports? Also, I mean, usually I swear more when I'm talking about this. It was sort of a swear word free update. Maybe that was what...
We were on a very tight deadline.
Normally we're on a very tight deadline.
I know, but
we've become more sweary because it's like, oh, don't have time to put facts. Let's just swear. But... but it does come back to what we've been saying all along, which is, I think, my position on this is YouTube exploiting a loophole in the law? Probably they are. Has that helped them get better rates and build their platform? It probably has. Should copyright owners try and close that loophole? They probably should. Will this fix all of the issues and problems of the digital music market? No. I mean, conceivably, it might help to an extent, although I'm not even convinced of that. Because, as we've always said, next stages, we were talking about process earlier, weren't we? So the jury committee have now passed Article 13 in its current form. Because this is quite a contentious piece of legislation, it will almost certainly now have to go to a full vote of the European Parliament. If it's uncontroversial, actually, the lead committee passing a directive is enough to take it through to the final stage. But this one will almost certainly have to go to a full vote of the Parliament, so that's still to come. Even once that goes through, it then the EU Council has to finalise their version, then we have that period where they all talk, and then the final version goes back to be rubber-stamped. And in theory, I mean, I say rubber-stamped, I mean, they could vote against the final version and kickstart a whole new stage, although they probably won't. Then it has to be implemented in national law, because it's a directive, so every country then has to amend their copyright laws to implement all of this, so that'll take probably at least a year. By that point, we would have Brexited, so it won't be relevant in the UK anymore. And then, I mean, who knows? It will depend to an extent on the final wording of Article 13, so not the version that's been passed yet, the final version. But I still suspect there will be enough ambiguity in the final version that probably the new law will need to be tested in court. That takes a very long time. So we're probably talking a few years away before we actually know what new liabilities these platforms have. And where will digital music be? I mean, a few years ago, we were still talking about the iTunes boom. And that all feels really antiquated now. And a few years before that, we were all talking about MySpace. And that feels like a lifetime ago now. So where will digital music be in 3 years' time? Will we still be complaining about the YouTubes of this world?
I hope not. I really want to move on to complaining about something else now.
I desperately hope we aren't still talking about the value gap in 3 years' time. But who knows? But anyway, those are the developments this week. I suspect, actually, there's not going to be a proper set list for a couple of weeks now. We're going to have some of our 20th anniversary, the drunk editions of the 20th anniversary specials. But there are more votes to come. So it may well be that when we are next back with a full edition of Setlist, that we just basically rerun the last 20 minutes. But maybe with a new quote from GSAC. But for the time being, the music industry feels that things are moving forward on the Value Gap campaign.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus the play count fixing rumours at Tidal reached the Prince estate. But now, the Fanfare anti-touting campaign has called on Google to make good on its past commitment to protect consumers looking to buy tickets online by ceasing to let Viagogo place adverts in its search engine. It also reckons that the web giant should extend its own rules so that all ticket resale sites are upfront about the unofficial status of their sellers in the text that appears in the adverts.
So this all relates to the decision Google made late last year that, in the context of all the campaigning against the secondary ticketing market and the various allegations that the secondary ticketing platforms, to an extent, are confusing consumers, possibly deliberately, into thinking that they are buying tickets from approved ticket agents appointed by the artist and or their promoter, rather than buying them off resellers or brokers or touts, if you prefer. And that's partly because what quite a few of the secondary ticketing platforms do, Viagogo in particular, but actually some of its competitors as well, is they spend most of their marketing budget on Google advertising, so that when you go and Google for Ed Sheeran tickets, the first thing in the list is a paid-for link to the Viagogo website where you can buy Ed Sheeran tickets, even though Ed Sheeran has made it very clear that he will cancel any tickets that he knows has been resold on Viagogo.
And in fact, at his recent Wembley Stadium show, he had a whole... There were like six windows at the box office for people who had... Well, it was, they just said victims of Viagogo above each window. Anyone who'd got a ticket from Viagogo and had then had it cancelled had somewhere to go.
Their own queue. So the point is, Viagogo and others, they pay to appear at the top of Google searches. And the argument is, lots of consumers, when they go and use Google, they don't realise that the top listing is there because somebody paid for it to be there. So actually, the lead organic listing, the listing that the algorithm has organically decided should be top, is the second one. So therefore, people are assuming that the top one is the official seller because it's going top, even though we know it's only there because they've paid for it to be there. And so because people were saying, well, that's confusing people into buying tickets from what they think are official sellers when they're not, and there was some witch research that said that of all the people they surveyed, about half of the people who had bought tickets from a Viagogo or a Seatwave or a StubHub thought they'd bought tickets from an official website, an official ticket seller, when in fact they bought them from a tout. It doesn't help that lots of official tickets companies have terrible websites.
Yes.
So people are used to having a terrible experience when they buy tickets online. And so people were saying, OK, Google, you're playing a role in this, in confusing people. You should do something about that. And late last year, Google said, all right then, any second ticketing site that advertises on the Google search platform, they will have to be certified in order to buy ads. And a condition of that will be, well, then they had a list of things that those websites have to do. And so one of those things is, on the website, they have to be clear that they are a marketplace for resellers. They are not an official primary seller. And there were some other things that Google said to the second ticketing sites. You need to do this, because if you don't, we won't let you advertise. And so they announced that late last year. It came into force at the start of the year. And yes, so what the fanfare campaign are saying is twofold. A, we think you should go further than that. That you should say to these companies, not only must they put on their own websites that they are not official sellers, that should actually be in the text of the advert. So it's apparent from the Google search page that these are resellers, not official sellers. But then the other thing they're saying is, okay, Viagogo has actually complied with at least one of the laws of Google, which is there is now a line at the top of the Viagogo site saying we're a marketplace, blah, blah, blah. But while they may comply with the laws of Google, they are not complying with the laws of this United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the various bits of ticket touting regulation that have come into effect. The Advertising Standards Authority made some demands of the second ticketing sites. Viagogo hasn't complied with that. So the Competition Markets Authority is thinking of taking Viagogo to court. National Trading Standards are investigating. And so basically what Fanfare is saying is, clearly Viagogo, everyone agrees, shady operator. Come on, Google. You said late last year that you were going to crack down on websites that seem to probably deliberately confuse customers. The time has come for you to make good on that and turn away Viagogo's advertising and therefore Viagogo's money.
Yes, as we record, Google has not responded to that demand. And as far as we know, Viagogo remains an advertiser on the Google platform.
It certainly was last time I checked.
So currently, Google is still taking Viagogo's money and Viagogo continues to confuse consumers.
In the statement that Fanfare put out last week, in addition to calling on Google to finally refuse to take adverts from Viagogo, they also put a bit more pressure onto the other second ticketing players here in the UK, because I think we've noted before on Setlist, because there's been so much bad press around Viagogo in the last year, you do sort of feel that StubHub, which is owned by eBay, and then Seatwave and Get Me In, which are owned by Live Nation's Ticketmaster, have sort of been quite gleefully hiding behind Viagogo in a sort of, you may not like what we do, but at least we're not Viagogo. And so Fanfare were putting a bit more pressure on to the other players as well. And so one thing that they said is, we have noticed that when you Google for certain shows, actually sometimes the top paid for listing is for Get Me In, which is one of Ticketmaster's sites. And they were saying, and this is what Fanfare's research has brought up, sometimes when a Get Me In link is at the top and a paid for slot pushing a page where you can buy touted tickets to a show, actually there are still face value tickets for that show available via the primary ticket agent, which quite often is Ticketmaster.
Yes.
So one Ticketmaster company is using Google advertising to divert people away from Ticketmaster in order to buy a touted ticket rather than the real ticket. And then StubHub, they don't have a legit ticketing company, but actually they do have partnerships with certain venues. So they are legit in that they have relationships. So like here in the UK, they have relationships with the O2 Arena and the Wembley Arena, which are both run by AEG. And they were saying same things happening there. Sometimes StubHub are using Google advertising to direct people to touted tickets for shows where official face value tickets are still available via the venue's own websites. And so they're basically saying that, okay, Viagogo is clearly the worst, but the other secondary sites, they should be looking at how they use Google advertising as well, because Fanfare reckons that they are employing marketing tactics which are confusing consumers.
One other development in secondary ticketing news last week was that the Fair Ticketing Alliance, which is a lobbying group set up to speak for ticket touts or brokers, as they prefer to be called, launched a new code of practice, which it said it hoped would build greater trust with live entertainment and music fans and help raise the ethical standards of the secondary ticketing sector. It also said that its code of practice went beyond what is currently demanded by law in the UK.
Yeah, so one of the things in their code of practice is that ticket brokers, ticket touts, whatever, who sign up to that organisation and sign up to that code of practice, for example, they won't tout tickets to charity shows, so shows that are there exclusively for the benefit of charity. And actually, I mean, Ed Sheeran's war against touting began when Viagogo were listing touted tickets for one of the big gigs he did for the Teenage Cancer Trust.
Yes.
And that's when Ed and his team got really angry about touting and subsequently really, really pushed back. But the other interesting thing about that code of practice is that it says that members of this organisation, just speaking up for the touts, should all comply with basically the guidelines that were set out by the UK Competition and Markets Authority earlier this year for secondary ticketing. And they should only use secondary ticketing websites that also comply with the rules put out by the Competition and Markets Authority, which is basically them saying our members will not sell tickets on Viagogo because Viagogo are not currently compliant. So yes, an interesting move from the Fair Ticketing Alliance there. And I suppose the quid pro quo that they are looking for is they're saying, OK, we'll make all these commitments that the ticket resellers will be more responsible, blah, blah, blah. And what they're looking for in return is a help under law that they have the right to resell tickets. And obviously, they're sort of pushing back on all of these promoters, like Ed Sheeran's promoters, who are, wherever they can find out that a ticket has been touted, they're cancelling those tickets. So they're sort of saying, we will be more responsible, we will promote more responsible reselling of tickets in return for the right to resell those tickets.
So the battle over secondary ticketing rages on, and I assume will continue to do so for some time yet, but we'll see. I mean, it's possible, even by the time you've heard this, that Google will have responded to the calls to ditch Viagogo. Certainly, I would assume that something more will have happened when we come back with another proper episode in a few weeks' time. So, yeah, we'll wait and see whether Google goes so far as to completely boot Viagogo off its system. Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. Let's kick off with the very sad news that Glasgow's ABC venue has burned down. You probably saw in the news recently that the Glasgow School of Arts Macintosh building had been destroyed by fire, but the ABC was adjoined to that and also was, we don't know the full extent of the damage yet, but basically looked like it was completely gutted. Certainly its roof fell in, and that's not a good sign.
I suppose because the art school building is very historic and a much admired piece of architecture, and it had a smaller fire a few years ago and they just spent a lot of money trying to renovate it. So obviously a lot of the focus was on the art school building, which, I mean, certainly it looked like it was pretty much gutted. And the question now is whether or not any of the exterior can be saved. But yeah, I mean, I suppose from a music fan's perspective, it was just as sad to hear that the building next door, which is, you know, it's been there a long time, seen various things over the years, but certainly in recent years, it's been a really good music venue in Glasgow, is looking pretty damn damaged as well. I suppose the good thing was, despite it being a really big fire, actually, you know, nobody was hurt. So I guess that's very much obviously the upside. But nevertheless, a real shame for the Glasgow music scene.
Singer Rebecca Ferguson is calling on the UK government to create a regulatory body for the music industry, particularly to protect young artists starting out in the industry against being taken advantage of with their initial contracts.
So yeah, she set up a petition calling for that action from government. I suppose there was a story a couple of months back, wasn't there, about a management company, I say management company in inverted commas, really, who were allegedly at least signing artists, but then telling them that the way it works when you are taken on by management is that they charge you fees for their work, and that some artists were handing over a few grand, which to them was an awful lot of money, and then the managers weren't really delivering anything that said they were going to deliver. So, you know, we have these terrible stories of artists being taken for a ride in that way. So what Rebecca Ferguson is calling for is some sort of protection for young artists like that. Although I sort of feel, I mean, I suppose we're biased because we do a bunch of educational stuff for young artists, but I do sort of feel we are now in an era where if you are starting out as an artist or as a music entrepreneur, the first thing to do is to find events. Okay, the ones we do, but there are lots of others as well. Go and find those events. Go and meet the people who are clearly, properly, actually working in the music industry and get the advice. I mean, there is so much advice out there now. Also, I mean, just Google it or go to, you know, like lots of the companies like Centric and TuneCore and companies like that will have content on their website. I think one of the great things about now is the information is out there to be grabbed about what you should be expecting and what you should be nervous about in a way that it wasn't sort of pre the web. So I don't know whether regulation is what we need. I think it is just more education and ensuring that everybody who has a passion for music has access to that information. Well, they do have access to it. I suppose they just need to know how to find it.
That said, people who are going to take advantage of you are going to find you in order to try to take advantage of you. And I think actually what Rebecca Ferguson was saying was actually there are lots of supposedly legitimate companies who will pressure artists into signing contracts without legal advice and basically kind of stacking the odds against them ever making any money, even if they do find success. So I agree. I don't know if a regulatory body is the same thing, but she's certainly very passionate about it. And she was saying if the government won't listen to her, she'll go to the EU. And if the EU won't listen to her, she'll go to the UN. I don't know if that's the UN's remit, but fine, go to the UN with it.
But in the meantime, I think the young artists starting out, I mean, we do work with both the Featured Artists Coalition and we've done training with the MU. So maybe I'm biased, but you know, go and join organisations like that, because both of those organisations, I know for a fact, will definitely tell you to never sign a contract without getting legal advice, and can also give you lots of great advice on what is normal and what isn't normal and what kind of deals you should be considering.
Will Ferrell is making a new comedy film for Netflix about the Eurovision Song Contest.
Which you seem to be very excited about.
No, I'm not at all.
Oh, right.
I think this is probably, almost certainly, going to be awful.
But are you excited about the prospect of there being an awful film about Eurovision? I suppose you're a bit of a Eurovision fan, so do you think that that's sacrilege?
Apparently Will Ferrell's quite a big fan of Eurovision because his wife is Swedish and she introduced him to it several years ago. And he was at the Eurovision Song Contest in Ukraine in May, speaking to various people involved and contestants. So he's not just someone who sort of heard about it on a 5-minute news piece once and went, oh, that would make a good comedy. Still think almost certainly going to be terrible.
Well, we shall see if and when this film actually gets released.
So the show notes for this episode will have links to all of these stories and everything we've discussed this week at setlistpodcast.com. And finally, this week, the bickering between Prince's heirs continues. The latest round of bickering sees three of his siblings seeking to have a deal done between the musician's estate and Tidal revoked. I mean, it was hard enough getting that deal back. It was a deal that Prince had done while he was alive that then the estate said he didn't do, and then they agreed a new deal. Now these three siblings of Prince are saying revoke that deal because of the alleged fiddling of play counts for Kanye West and Beyonce, which we discussed in a recent episode.
Yes, so as you say, although Prince himself formed a formal partnership with Jay-Z and Tidal before he died, after his death, there was then a big dispute about exactly what that partnership was and what rights and what exclusive rights Tidal had over Prince's catalogue. We talked about that on Setlist. I'm not sure we talked about the settlement because I think it happened around about The Great Escape and we were probably on a week off.
Perhaps we missed that.
So eventually they agreed a deal where they settled all the past legal squabbling over what rights Tidal did or didn't have to Prince's catalogue. And as part of that settlement, they also announced that, I think, is it later this year or early next year? At some point in the near future, they're going to put out a posthumous album of previously unreleased Prince recordings, and Tidal will have an albeit quite short-term exclusive on that. Well, they're a bit ambiguous. They'll have a complete exclusive for a week, I think. Then it'll be available for download. Then it'll be available on CD, but it might be that when it comes to streaming, they've got a longer-term exclusive. I don't know. But anyway, that was the deal that was reached in mid-May. But because the Prince estate is still going through all the motions, that deal, settling the past litigation and doing this exclusivity deal, had to be approved by the court that is overseeing the Prince estate. So that happened in early May before the announcement. But, well, pretty much ever since Prince died, most of them are half-siblings, aren't they? But anyway, they're sort of his brothers and sisters have sort of split into two groups.
Yes.
In terms of how the Prince estate is managed, who should be running it, what deals they should be doing. And so there's been quite a lot of squabbling ever since Prince died, really. And it seems that one half of the heirs, they are not happy with the Tidal deal. And as you say, they've basically gone back to court and saying, OK, you approved this deal in early May, but we think you should now reconsider that because of all those Tidal allegations.
Yes. So if you're just catching up with this, the allegations against Tidal, which were from a Norwegian newspaper, said that Tidal had artificially increased play counts for the exclusive albums that it had by Kanye West and Beyonce. And the problem with that is not just, you know, it's Tidal trying to make its exclusives look more popular, allegedly, but also that if those albums have higher play counts, they get a higher cut of the royalties across the Tidal platform, and therefore all the other artists on the platform, including Prince, get a lower cut of the royalties. So these three heirs, so that's Sharon Nelson, Noreen Nelson, and John R. Nelson, have asked the court to reconsider the approval of the deal that was done earlier this year because of those allegations, because if they turn out to be true, then, well, presumably they'd have to go legal over what royalties they have received to this point.
Except if they are true, and we should stress once again.
Allegedly.
Tidal are very adamant that there is no truth in these rumours. But if there was truth in the rumour that Tidal is prone to heighten the stats on albums that it has the exclusive rights to, and therefore those albums get more money than perhaps they're due, if you've just done a deal granting Tidal an exclusive on an album, surely that's a good thing.
Also, Prince already had exclusive albums on Tidal. I think remain exclusive to Tidal.
Yeah, his last two.
So maybe keep quiet.
So who knows? But crucially, when we get to the legalities of this, so these three heirs said, OK, we want you to reconsider this deal. And then legal reps for the Prince estate, who I assume are also speaking for the other heirs, what they said was, no, there are only two grounds under which the court could go back to a decision it's already made like this and reconsider. And one is if there's a significant new legal development. The other is if it can be shown that previous decision was palpably wrong in some respect. And what they're basically saying is, this is just rumours in a Norwegian newspaper that Tidal deny. That does not tick either of those boxes, so there are no grounds for the court to reconsider this deal.
Now, as we said, there have been an assortment of disagreements between Prince's siblings and half-siblings over the management of his estate and the deals done on behalf of the estate since his death in 2016, including there was obviously the big recordings deal that Universal did, the $30 million deal that then collapsed and was revoked. We're still waiting for a new recordings deal to be done, and there is a rumour now that Sony is going to take on those recordings, which I think we've previously said it would make more sense for Warner to take them on, but apparently Sony is the preferred bidder at the moment.
Yeah, Variety were quoting sources to that effect quite recently. The reason why the Universal deal fell apart is that before he died, Prince did a deal with Warner, who obviously were his record company way back in the day. Then he had a massive falling out with them in the 90s. And then he did a new deal a few years ago. But it turns out that deal is so complicated that nobody really understands what recordings are covered by that deal and what recordings aren't covered by that deal.
Yeah, so Universal did this massive deal and then went and looked at the contracts and went, don't actually know what we've just bought.
But we suspect that the really, you know, famous 1980s Prince recordings that we thought we were going to get access to quite soon, maybe we're not going to get them for a very long time because Warner have those rights. So we don't want to do this deal. So yeah, as you say, therefore the logic would be just to say, well, why don't we do it with Warner? Because then there'll be none of that problem. Except obviously Warner would exploit that to their advantage to get sort of a much more reasonable upfront advance. So we'll wait and see whether or not that Sony deal comes through. And if it does, which of the heirs will object to it?
It'll certainly be some. But that's all we got time for this week. So we can't sit around here waiting for them to disagree with a deal that hasn't yet been announced. You can continue engaging with our content by following us on social media. We're Setlist Pod all over the place. Or why don't you just chat with us directly via email on setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt, that's me, and Chris Cook, that is not me. It's produced by Matt Peaty, not me, and edited by Jason Wolfe. Spoiler alert, not me. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.